up. There it is. There it is. The importance of a theme song. You know, you're sitting here, you got my head down on the table, trying to go to sleep, trying to take a nap. Josh informed me that the government just ran out of naps. So I don't know what I'm going to do with that. But yeah, anyway, I don't know if I can even get a rebate on my naps. Tried taking naps yesterday. It didn't work.
Do you have the receipt?
I believe I'll have to look in my pocket.
Yeah, take a look and see if you've got that, because if you do, I think you're good to go. But
so, Fish and Frank here, Robert in the chair across from me, RJ in the chrome and gold towers of powers looking down upon us in, well, disbelief.
You forgot to mention the pearl.
The pearl?
The pearlescent sheen that his tower has.
Ah, yeah, it does have a pearlescent sheen. You know, looking at it now, I can see that reflecting. But I think that's mostly reflecting off of Josh Olive, the fish coach who happens to be here. He has a pearlescent sheen, and we won't go into anything reflecting above him.
Listen, that's plain chrome. Catch me in the sun sometime, and you'll see it.
Okay. Now, it's been windy, so not going to be a lot of reports from the Gulf, but it's been kind of strange with the fishing. Everybody's complaining, you know, around the beginning of the year, the fishing isn't that good and all that. And then the fishing became spectacular. I mean, really good. Lots of fish all over the place. And the common denominator is, wait for it. You ready? Okay. Stable weather. Now, I'm going to call stable weather the big difference between at the beginning of the year where people couldn't find fish, they didn't know where to go, what to do, they were having a hard time, oh, the fishing's bad. I said, no, the fishing's not bad, it's pretty good, but we had a month of stable weather. We had relatively calm winds for most of the days, the temperature was pretty much the same, and the fishing, everybody was, wow, this is some of the best fishing we've ever had.
It's an interesting hypothesis.
All right. Well, let's go ahead. RJ, any reason other than stable weather you can think of for so many fish being caught?
No, and the stable weather thing has got me on the fool side. How does that affect overall fishing to have stable weather?
Well, I think the fish can find a place and get happy with it. The bait finds a place, gets happy with it. You know, and right now the fishing is not very good. We've had front after front after front. So yeah, the fishing decreased dramatically.
And I think there's a lot to be said for your idea of stable weather. Stable weather is a good thing for sure. But I'm not sure that that's really what drove us to have such great fishing over such a short period of time. I think that there might be another factor in play, which is not just that the weather was stable, but it was stable summery weather. It got hot, and it got hot quick. And I think that we may also have experienced what normally is our spring fishing, which takes place over the course of about 2 months or so as things start moving north. We got it all in the course of 3 weeks. So everything kind of got compacted in, where what normally gets stretched out over a period of time just happened all at once.
Robert?
I like that idea.
Well, basically it boils down to the weather stabilized. It was awesome temperatures. It wasn't hot. It wasn't cold. And the fish were able, we had tons of bait around. There was a lot of fish around. And the stability. But I've noticed no matter, even if it's cold all the time, or if it's warm all the time, or even hot, as long as it's the same thing, I think people can key in on where the fish are, where they're holding. Whereas when it's bouncing, 1 week it's, you know, in the 40s, and the next week it's in the 80s, and the next week it's in the 50s, you know, going up and down all over the map, people really can't key in on where the fish are, because I don't think the fish are keying in on where they are.
Sure, and Robert and I talk about that all the time when we do the fishing reports for the magazine. You know, you can tell what the weather's been like by how good the fishing report is. If the weather's been bouncing all over the place, then the fishing report basically consists of, hey, go out there and look for fish because they might be in a lot of different places right now. Whereas when the weather's been more stable, here's where the fish are, go catch them.
All right, well, RJ, I can conclude that I was correct.
Well, I'm going to drill down a little further here, and I'm going to say it's probably water temperature, and that the water temperature is staying relatively stable, which means the shallow areas are warmer, the deeper areas a little cooler, and so fish find the environment that they like. So you're going to find certain species in the shallower water, certain species in the deeper water. And because the weather's not changing the temperature rapidly, of especially the surface waters, I think that is what stabilizes the fishing.
All right. So in other words, I was right.
So in other words,
I'll
you were right. That. Yes, yes. We'll go
well,
with that.
I'll just go with that.
Frank was right.
I think you get partial credit for telling part of the story.
What is this note you've got on your phone here? What's that about?
No, I just have that sitting there for later, just in case.
What is it?
just if it happens to pop up. I have that for later.
In case it happens to pop up, but we don't know what it is.
In case I need it.
Yeah. In case we run out of things to talk about.
When
has that ever happened? We've been doing this for how long?
Okay.
There was a threat that was made earlier.
Tails
before
and a
the
silver spoon. I'm going to go out and catch a poon. I don't know. How does that go?
You screwed it up completely. Can you at least hum it for me so I can sing along with that? I don't want to do a cappella.
I'll join you. Just tell me. You start. And a one, and a two, and a three, and a four.
And a catfish tail and a silver spoon. Gonna go fish, gonna catch me a poon. Gonna use my reaper and my pen, and then I'm gonna reel him in.
That's
you know I'm
what's
gonna
on
reel
your
him
phone.
In. Why didn't you hum?
I knew there was something on his phone.
Yep, there you go.
You can take the gun off my head now, okay? I'm done.
That was awesome. Encore. Okay, the studio audience goes crazy. All right.
I can hear my wife rolling her eyes, by the way.
I don't know. I thought it was pretty good.
Oh, so, well.
Yeah, now I got to...
I'm glad I'm up here and not down there.
I got to get it out of my head now. Okay.
So the purpose of that song, you know, we were talking about all the warm weather, you know, tarpon have showed up all over the place out there, and they're catching them in the harbor, along the beaches, definitely in the passes and the intercoastal. And an old school technique that a lot of the old timers used for many years was catfish tails for bait.
Wow, catfish tails.
Mm-hmm. But
not
a lot of people
the
don't
finny
think it
part
works.
Of the tail, the meaty part of the tail.
Yeah.
The back half of a catfish.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah. No, I've seen that done, and I just think nobody was doing that anymore. That's pretty cool.
They still do it, and the funny part is they seem to only want to do it in a couple select areas along the intercoastal, especially down in, like, Fort Myers, Cape Coral area. But it works so unbelievably well.
I think the other big place, Robert, is on the Peace River.
Yeah, up in the upper river, absolutely.
When you go from Harbor Heights up the river, catfish tails are a staple for bait for tarpon. And it's funny you don't see people in the middle holes doing it, even though they're loaded with catfish.
And it does work. That's the crazy part is that last year a few people were trying it out. We're starting to see this year with a few more people trying it out again. So I think it's kind of gaining a little bit more forward momentum with more and more people wanting to try it out.
Well, I don't think people really know that tarpon eat catfish. And when catfish hatch out, obviously they're very tiny. As they get up to be an inch or two long, it's not uncommon to see a tarpon go through a school of these little baby catfish just with their mouth open, sucking them in by the dozens or hundreds or whatever they do. But from the time, you know, pretty much every fish grows up eating catfish at one point or another.
Well, and let's talk about tarpon in particular. You know, we used to talk a lot more than we do these days about how hard tarpon are to hook, and part of that has been that a hook out of the package now is way sharper than the sharpest hook you could ever hone not that many years ago. Tarpon have gotten a little bit easier to hook, but the insides of their mouths have not gotten any less hard, and it's hard for a reason, and part of the reason is that they eat things like catfish that, you know, you and I would be in real trouble if we put a whole catfish in our mouths. But a tarpon has no issue with that at all.
Not Robert.
What? No.
So I've got two questions.
Leave Fluffy alone.
Yes. I'm glad you guys woke him up. But how would you rig the back half of a catfish? And that's question number one. And question number two is, if you decide to do this, where are you going to get the catfish from? You don't sell catfish at the bait.
No, you just want to catch them because they're always better fresh. But first thing is you get a bait down by the bottom, shrimp, squid, whatever, be even on a jig head or just a hook with a sinker. But when you get them up in the boat, the first thing I do is throw them in a bucket and let them die in the bucket, because you do not want to handle a live catfish trying to cut them up for bait the way you would a ladyfish or a mullet or something like that. I want them to expire in a bucket first. Then I go run my fingers down the catfish till I find the end of the ribs. And now, keeping in mind, freshwater catfish are very different than saltwater catfish. They are not the same creature at all. No similarity. But you run your fingers down. When you find the end of the ribs, you make a cut there through the spine, just cut a chunk off. And then you go to the fin part of the tail and cut that off. Now you're left with this little triangular shape of, you know, meat there. And I would say for a tarpon, you're cutting four fingers, Robert?
Well, I'll use the whole tail no matter what the size of catfish is.
So you're in for the whole
tail.
I don't see any reason to cut a chunk other than to get more smell out there, having scent coming off both sides of it.
Well,
that's why I
cut the fin off right in front of the joint, so that I'm exposed on both ends. I don't want that fin on there, because if you leave that tail fin on, it tends to rotate in the water, spins your line up, twist everything up, everything gets destroyed. But you're in for cutting that whole tail, using the whole tail section, huh, Robert?
Yeah, I prefer to use the whole tail. And I think the main reason for it is that, you know, the catfish usually are a little bit smaller that you tend to catch anyway, so it's not exactly a really large piece of meat anyhow. And it seems like the catfish really prefer, out of the two species we have, they seem to like the hardhead catfish more so than they do the sail cat.
So tarpon...
They'll eat them both, but it works
now,
the other way.
The way you identify between a sail cat or gaff top sail cat and a hardhead catfish, or mud cat, whatever you want to call them, is the length of the fins. Other than that, they're pretty much the body, the head, the face all kind of look the same. But the sail cat has, gaff top sail cat, has a long extension to the dorsal fin and the two pec fins. They can be anywhere from 4 to 8, maybe even 10 inches long, where with a hardhead cat, they're more like a normal fin on a fish. And they're anywhere from an inch to, say, 2 inches with no extensions on them. So the hardhead is theoretically the preferred bait, but I don't really see that I've had a difference in throwing sail cat body and hardhead. Now, the one weird thing is gaff top sail cats can get the same parasites as a black drum, but neither a redfish, which is very closely related, close enough they can spawn, black drum and red drum, or redfish and black drum, and sail cat and hardhead don't get the parasites. Could that be why possible the tarpon would prefer the hardhead cats to the sail cat, the parasite?
Yeah, I mean, I honestly don't know the answer fully to it. My only theory on it is that the sail cat is much slimier.
It does have the most slime of any fish on it.
Yeah, and that's the only, like, visible significant difference that I can see.
RJ, discussion?
Well, the slime is a deterrent to other fish, you know, in addition to the spines and things like that. So.
Well, I can see the spine, sort of. Why would the slime be?
I'm going to assume, you know, you get that slime on your hands and it starts to tingle and doesn't feel all that good, and I think that... Hmm. It's releasing something into the water that lets other fish know this is a catfish and you probably shouldn't eat them.
Well, it could be.
I guess it could be. Mm. Let's collect some slime and analyze it in the lab.
Yes.
And see what
Who's
we come
lab?
Up with.
Whoever has the most delicate hands in the group.
You must have a lab. Now, listen, there's a specific reason.
I had a golden retriever, but I have never had a lab.
There's a specific reason for me that I'm not going to be using the sail cats as tarpon bait. And that's because if those sail cats are big enough anyway, I'm throwing them in the cooler and taking them home to eat.
Okay.
Really?
Well, there's one.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you eat the hardheads?
Well, lack of courage is what it comes down to. They are two related species, but they're not that closely related. And looking at the way those fish behave, a sail cat is much more of a predator than the hardhead cat is. Sail cats like to chase things down. Sail cats, if they're around and they're feeding on bait fish, they're pretty easy to catch on artificial lures. I've only caught a couple of hardheads ever on artificial baits, and it's been scented baits that were fished very close to the bottom. A hardhead is much more of a scavenger. So between those two fish, if I'm going to eat a fish that is a predator or a scavenger, I'm usually going to go for a predator.
You know, Robert, predator or scavenger, doesn't make a difference.
I mean, edibility-wise, I'm going to probably go with Josh on that one, with the predator being a little bit more dietary specific. You know, I mean, how many times have you been out there shark fishing or even red fishing and using live bait fish or even a topwater and had a sail cat come up and eat it versus a hardhead? I've never ever caught a hardhead that I can recall on a lure.
Robert, which would you rather eat, a black tip shark or a bull shark?
Okay.
Well, the black tip is more of the predator, and the bull shark is more of the scavenger. Which would you rather eat, a red grouper or a gag grouper?
No.
The amberjack.
RJ, is it, in your mind, difference, predator, scavenger, taste-wise?
I've never thought of that before. That was a brain opener, that there's going to be a difference in how the meat's going to be flavored. But what threw me off in the conversation is the sail cat will get parasites and the mud cat doesn't.
Do the parasites
know something that we don't know?
I don't know.
I can't vouch for it. I've cut open probably 100 sail cats now to fillet for the table, and I've not seen any that have parasites in the meat. At least not the same kind of parasite that you would expect to see in a
little
in a black drum
with the long squiggly tail on them.
Yeah, I haven't seen that.
Here's the thing. People are going, oh, Josh, you eat sail cats. Well, there's a few states where sail cats are actually on the game fish. They're actually considered game fish. Now, in Florida, we have our own set of rules, what's good and what's bad, and quite often very contradictory to the rest of the world. It doesn't really have anything to do with what's good and what's bad. Like, Jack Crevel is my favorite smoked fish. If you have a smoker and, you know, a slab of a Jack Crevel is just awesome. I hate smoked mullet. You got really nice meat on the outside, then it gets really nasty in the middle. I just don't like smoked mullet at all. But with a Jack Crevel, you get this beautiful, even taste and flavor. Now, getting into the sail cats, what's your recipe on the sail cat, Josh?
It's basically the same as the way I would do a freshwater catfish, cut up into chunks and fried. Make catfish nuggets out of it. You know, I get a lot of people give me flack for that, and they're like, oh, they're so disgusting, they're so slimy, they're so nasty. Well, I'm not eating the outside of the catfish. When you prep a catfish, you peel the skin away. So I don't care how slimy the outside is, the inside is delicious.
All right, and we know that the slime on a fish is the epidermal layer. And the epidermal layer is what keeps, in the time of coronavirus, we all should be very aware of our epidermal layer. And that's what keeps viruses, bacteria, and stuff from penetrating our skin. If you get cut, it's the break in the epidermal layer that allows this bad stuff in and allows you to become infected.
So in humans, there's a similar thing in our internal bodies where you've got that coating of slimy stuff on the inside of your trachea and on the inside of your lungs. And when you cough, you get those lung oysters when you're sick. What you're doing is you're getting rid of a lot of the pathogens that are infecting your body. And the same thing for the catfish. That slime will catch that stuff And as the slime washes away, so do the pathogens. They don't get in.
What makes them visually unappealing from the outside, the extra slime and all that, is actually makes them way more of a safe fish to eat. They're one of the safest fish, you know, for as far as they are predator. And they have a massive slime coating on them, so the chances of having tainted meat on a sail cat is very slim.
Yeah, it's one way that they can survive in areas where other fish don't. It's one reason why we see so many catfish up in the canals and hanging out in warm water areas where bacterial counts are high, and other fish start to get weird sores on their bodies, and they look horrible when you catch them. But that's a rare, rare thing to see on a catfish of any kind.
So anyway, there you go, boys and girls.
And I think that's another reason why tarpon feed so heavily on them too, is because catfish are one of the few fish that can adapt to very low oxygen levels and can be found in all sorts of types of water scenarios, same way with a tarpon. I mean, a tarpon can live in virtually no oxygenated water. Catfish seem to have a very high tolerance for that, so they're found in those back little marshes and swamps and bayous as little guys all the way up to bigger guys.
So what you're saying is they'd be a prevalent food source even in these really areas where most fish couldn't live in. The baby catfish would be back there and the tarpon would be likely to feed on them.
Right. And I think they just keep focused on that throughout their entire livelihood.
All right. So stringers of fish. This is one thing, a bone of contention. Let's put it that way. It's like eating a really nice filet and then finding out there's a bone in it and you got to eat a half a loaf of bread to get it to wash down out of your throat. The bone of contention with these is, should you be keeping stringers of fish? Irrelevant of species, irrelevant of all that, is it okay to do or not okay to do? Now, if it was a stringer of trout, no, you only allow four. But some of these fish you're allowed bunches of. And what about non-native species, guys? Is it okay to have a stringer of Mayan cichlids or tilapia? RJ, what do you think? Is this something you should or shouldn't do?
Well, I haven't given that a lot of thought. I'm pretty much catch and release kind of guy. You know, we used to trout fish. We had a creel, and you throw the trout in the creel.
Right.
But I haven't really, really used stringers all that much.
All right, Josh. We're seeing this on internet, and
yeah,
everything and on the internet is nasty, mean, and horrible, and that's why we're on a social media blackout for a while, because of the virus, and, you know, we just don't want to get involved.
People are pent up right now, and they're feeling a little hostile towards each other. We've even seen that in some of our interpersonal relationships lately, where we've just been getting more hostile than we normally would be. And so, of course, taking it out on strangers on the internet is great, because then you don't have to deal with any repercussions later. Personally, I don't mind people taking large harvests of fish like the Mayan cichlids and the tilapia, as long as two things. Number one, as long as you're going to use it, and as long as you're not trying to rub it in other people's faces about how I'll go out and kill whatever I want, whenever I want, however I want, because I just
can. Yeah. And I don't like that.
I don't like that attitude, but I don't like that attitude in anybody for any reason. So,
Robert, when you're looking at these pictures on the internet and you're seeing a guy with a big stringer of Mayan cichlids, now they're very edible fish and they're very tasty, but I don't know how many you can really eat at a sitting, but if you got a family of four, you could probably go through, I'd say, at least 8 or 10 in a sitting.
Oh, yeah, easily. I've got no problems with them taking that stringer of an invasive species. My biggest problem that I have is, obviously, A, them doing it because they think they should or can. My biggest problem I have with it is most people, regardless of the fish species, don't know how to properly freeze stuff. Mm-hmm. So let's say they're going to just only do this temporarily, but they want to get a little bit of a stockpile going, because let's say they're going camping for the weekend and they want to have a month's worth of fish, so they're going to have
a month's worth of camping.
Well, no. Let's say they go camping.
I'd almost rather be, you know, coronavirus locked in my apartment. You know,
I think.
Let's say they go camping for a weekend.
Okay, now we'll go along camping for a weekend.
But they're trying to get a month's worth of fish on their camping trip, right? Yeah,
and these are a species that number one, the Game and Fish says you're not supposed to release them back into the water. So they're not native. They're a problem to our native animals in general. So I kind of understand that a little bit, but you're never going to eradicate them. These things are here to stay forever. But the thing is, if they decide to keep even a 2 days' worth of food, most people don't know how to store them properly, freeze them properly, any of that stuff. And that's where the problem is. They end up wasting it for no apparent reason other than they were in a hurry, lazy, and didn't want to educate themselves on how to do it properly.
Hold on. I got to point out something quick. Game and Fish doesn't say that you're not supposed to release those fish. What they say is you're not allowed to release that fish anywhere that you didn't, except where you caught it and immediately. So if I catch a Mayan cichlid, I take them off the hook, throw them back in the water, that's perfectly fine. If I take a Mayan cichlid, pop them off the hook, turn around, throw them in the pond next door, then that's not permitted. If I catch a Mayan cichlid, pop them off the hook, put them in a 5-gallon bucket, take him home, let him swim around my aquarium for 3 days, and then bring him back and put him back in the pond where I caught him, that's not allowed either. But as long as I'm releasing him right back where he was caught, it's perfectly fine.
Okay.
All right.
Can I have a redo on my answer?
Yes, that's where I was going to now.
Good, because I completely misinterpreted the question. And I learned a lot in the process. I'm going to go with Robert and the idea that you only take what you're going to use. And to bring home 20 fish and you're not a pro at filleting things and things like that, you're just going to waste them. It's going to go into garbage or it's not going to get, like Robert said, it's not going to be frozen properly. So you got to know your limits on both sides. How much can you use? And how much can you process?
Let me ask you this.
Here's my question. Wait a minute, Jeff. Sorry about that. This has been brought up by two of you now. All right. We're going to go around each of us. And, Josh, starting with you, how do you freeze a fish to keep it good?
How do I freeze a fish personally? I put it in a vacuum bag, and I suck all the air out of it. And that keeps my fish fresh for at least 4 or 5 months, which is about as long as I've kept them in there. So it probably would last longer.
All right. Robert, how do you properly freeze a fish?
Most species of fish that I've seen last the longest is vacuum sealing them.
All right. So that's two for vacuum. RJ?
Yeah, I'm going to go 3 because that's how I do it.
All right. As always, I'm a little different. I don't have a vacuum sealer, but I do have access to distilled water. Now, that's going to be the key to this. If you use tap water, it doesn't work very well. You can do this technique with tap water, but if you get distilled water, which Publix, Winn-Dixie, any of these places, they usually have bottles of distilled water there. Distilled water is water that's been boiled and then reclaimed the steam, so there's very little in it. I'll put the fillets in a plastic bag, pour in the distilled water, take the air out, seal it. Now, what this does is encase those fish in ice. Now, the neat part about it is you can watch the air go towards your fish through the clear water. When you freeze distilled water or very pure water, it freezes clear. And as the air starts to go into it, where you would see, okay, it's going to get freezer burned, you can literally watch the air penetrate into the ice. And so that's the way I've done it many times, because I can just put it in a Ziploc, I seal it, rub it kind of flat, lay it flat in the freezer, and they stack up nice. But the ice protects them against freezer burn.
And I think your method is okay. I mean, that's a time-honored way of keeping air from getting to your fish. But the problem comes when you go to thaw that out, and now you've got a piece of raw fish that's sitting in that water, and that water will change the texture of the meat, and I don't like the way that it changes it. So what I used to do before I had a vacuum sealer, when I was looking for another method to use, and it doesn't last quite as long as the vacuum sealer does. If you're keeping them in the freezer for more than about 40 days using this method, things are not going to go well for it. But just get yourself some freezer zipper bags and a bucket of water, and put your fish into the zipper bag, leave the end open at the top, and pull the bag down into the water from below, and all the air gets sucked out through the top. And just before the tip of the bag goes into the water and starts sucking water into it, zip it closed. And now you've got basically a vacuum-sealed bag. It's not going to be as tightly sealed because it's only sealed with the zipper, but it does last a fairly long time.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, that was a great idea.
Yeah. I invited you up for a reason today. That was it.
I thought it was for the song.
And we also know we need to get Frank for Christmas.
A bucket of water?
Yeah.
Well, commercial fish houses, you know, especially like Alaska, where a lot of people go up there to fish and want to bring back their catch. I mean, they've been doing it for 25, 30 years that I'm aware of. They always ship them out vacuum sealed. And even in some of these third world countries, you know, like Panama, there's a couple of those fishing lodges down there where they ship back the tuna and other fish for their customers that come down to them, and they're all vacuum sealed. So it just shows how successful it is, more or less.
Right. Now, I'm probably the only person on the planet that would have liked to have seen them keep up with the gamma radiation stuff. It radiates the stuff, kills all the bacteria, anything on it, and it's you can actually leave it pretty much raw, with nothing done to it, and it stays good for literally weeks. And it's because with no bacteria on it, it's not going to rot. So you can have much fresher meat, much fresher stuff, simply by one time going through and wiping out all the bacteria. It's like right now, people, they say, you know, if you want to make something safe, you throw it in the microwave for a little while, and that'll kill any viruses or anything else. I would add one thing to that. And most of the rules they come up with and how long stuff lives on everything is for the northern states. I would really like to know. My car sits in the parking lot, my truck. I guarantee there's no coronavirus in it because I leave it sit in the sun. I get in there, it's 140 degrees in that truck. So I just sit in there as long as I can, you know, wait. Okay. All right, now that's too hot. Start the motor up, kick on the AC. But I'm pretty sure I'm killing most anything. That 140 degrees of that, that's a lot. I don't think anything lives in that, do they?
Well, I'm sure something does. I mean, if we go to the bottom of the ocean and we look for thermal vents where the water is well above normal boiling temperature, we can find all kinds of stuff living there around those vents. So
I'm going to say, okay.
I don't think you're going to boil life out of existence. Can I ask my question that I wanted to ask
earlier?
All right,
you ask your question.
Okay. So we were talking about the waste of the fish. And my question is, would you consider it to be waste if I'm taking those tilapia and Mayan cichlids, fish that the FWC would really like you to get rid of anyway, and I'm using them to make something like fish meal, or I'm grinding them up to add to my chum, or I'm burying them in the garden to feed my roses. Would you consider that to be waste, or is that a good use of those fish?
Robert?
I think it's a good use of those fish.
So you think that's okay? Grab a 5-gallon bucket full of them, take them home, throw them in the rose garden, or make chum out of them?
Yeah.
RJ?
Yeah, I'll go along with that, too. Because you know, we were talking about you got to use the fish. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to eat it. But if you got something that you can do with that fish rather than just tossing it in the garbage can, or, you know,
but that's also dealing with a non-native species.
You know, right, yeah, we're not talking about largemouth bass here.
Yeah, we're not talking about largemouth bass or, like, Spanish mackerel or something like that.
Right.
That, you know, it's... None of our fish, period, are like a infinite population of them. So it's like it can also be a problem. But when you're dealing with something that's competing against your native species and you're trying to...
All right, but what about Oscars? They went from an invasive species, oh my God, the world's going to end, to the thing that saved the Glades. It provided recreation for fishermen. It provided food for everything else. Oscars have become the reason the Everglades came back. The bass are doing well because they've got Oscar to eat. If it wasn't for a non-native species, the Glades would be dead now.
Well, and in 10 years, we're probably going to be a totally different discussion because of Mayan cichlids, because they're such, they have such a high tolerance for salt water compared to some of your other non-native species, that in 10 years from now, they might be the mullet, because the mullet's going to be out of existence, you know, so it might fill in that niche where that, you know, the whole conversation might be completely reversed then.
And well, the only reason we don't have those things overrunning the harbor right now is because they haven't been very cold tolerant. You know, every time we get an actual freeze, it knocks those fish back farther south again. The ones that are farther north in our area get killed.
Right.
So, I mean, but that's a fish that when we've had several warm winters in a row, all of a sudden you start hearing about people catching them on the mangrove shorelines while they're fishing for snook.
I've seen their beds up in the Mayaca Cutoff and down the West Wall a couple different times.
Yeah, and that's a species that, believe it or not, a freshwater cichlid from Central America has been documented spawning on a coral reef in the Florida Keys.
Yeah, I've seen that. I read that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, on a similar vein, there is one fish, believe it or not, you are not allowed to cut up in any form or fashion for bait. And it's a very popular fish. People eat it. It's the most prevalent fish in Charlotte Harbor right now. If I was going to make a bet, I would say it's my number one best bet for you to go catch. And people cut this up for bait all the time. And it actually, FWC has special laws against it. You're not allowed to cut it up in any way, shape, or form to use for bait. Even butterflying is illegal, as far as I remember. But Spanish mackerel,
right?
It's, as far as I know, you're not allowed to cut it up. You can't cut it up for bait. It has a size and a limit on it. So under no circumstances can you cut it into chunks.
Correct.
If you were going to keep a trout and then cut it into pieces to use for bait, that's exactly the same thing as using a Spanish mackerel.
Right.
Because once something has a size limit on it, you can't measure and say, okay, here, I set these pieces together, here's how long it was. You cannot cut it in half. It has a size limit on it. So you're not allowed to use Spanish mackerel for cut bait in any circumstances.
Right.
But I even think they made a special law about something. You're not allowed to use, even butterfly them. RJ, why do you suppose so many people are using them? It's great shark bait, without a doubt. It's good tarpon bait. It's good for, you know, king mackerel, grouper. But it's illegal to do. Why do you think so many people do it?
Probably they don't know, because I'm sitting here thinking, I didn't know that. Not that that's any big deal, but I didn't know that.
Well,
so ignorance of the law, I know, is no excuse.
But now, would you consider cutting a grouper up for bait?
Well, no, because the grouper is going to be really good eating, and a lot of people don't eat mackerel, so.
But what about, I don't know, mangrove snapper? Can you cut that up for bait?
I have no idea.
No, it's got a size limit on it.
Size limit, okay.
And a bag limit.
You got the size and bag limit on mackerel.
I can see this scenario fish. Now. The FWC guy saying, was this fish the legal size? And you assemble all the pieces for him, and it's a little short, and you reach in the bait bucket, and you grab an extra piece and stick it in there so that it meets the slot limit. Yeah, I can see why they don't want you to do that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you grab another chunk out of the thing. No, this one was more
than
legal.
Yeah, this one goes to it. Yeah, we were missing that piece.
You know, I got two dorsal fins, but still, it's legal.
Now, that was an odd fish.
Here's a fun little extra piece to throw in there. Ciro mackerel. Ciro mackerel don't have a bag limit or a size limit. There's nothing that would prevent you from cutting up Ciro mackerel to use for bait. But king mackerel and Spanish mackerel both do have those bag and size limits, and there's the landed ashore and whole condition requirement, which if you go through your FWC rule book, you'll see that a lot of species have a note that they have to be landed ashore in whole condition. So, what does it mean to be landed ashore in whole condition? Basically, what it means is that possessing that fish in a condition where it has been beheaded, sliced, divided, filleted, ground, scaled, skinned, or deboned is prohibited when you are on the water or when you are on a public or private fishing pier or a bridge or a jetty or any place like that where you would actually fish. So just because you landed it ashore while you were fishing on the jetty, you reeled it in and you now have it on land, doesn't mean you can cut it up and cast it out for bait because you landed it ashore in whole condition. Doesn't work that way. So lot of people out there breaking these laws.
I'm going to say it's the number one violation we hear about every day.
Well, you know, I know of guys that have grinders on the transom of their boat, and anytime they get something they don't want to keep, it goes through the grinder and becomes chum. So I'm taking it that that's not legal also.
Well, it depends on the species. I mean, if for example...
Ladyfish is good.
Or a skipjack. That's perfectly fine. Go ahead, grind him up. A bluefish? No, a bluefish has a size and a bag limit. He has to be landed ashore in whole condition. You can't grind him up. And you definitely can't grind him up if he's only 10 inches long and he's too small for you to put in the cooler.
Help
so you're
going to
throw him in the chum grinder. You can't do that.
No, right? I want to grow up.
Now, this also makes for another weird little catch in the law, which is, if we catch our fish and we land them ashore in whole condition, let's take Spanish mackerel as an example, and I've got my carcasses of Spanish mackerel that are left over. I've got heads, I've got tails, I've got the little bit of meat that's left down the backbone. I take that, I put it in a grinder, I freeze it for chum for later. As soon as I take it out on the water, I've just broken the law because now I'm in possession of the Spanish mackerel that's been ground to be used for bait. There's no proof that I didn't catch it while I was out there on the water, grind it up, and put it in this bucket.
Okay.
Now, getting caught with that is almost impossible, but just so you know.
Here's the thing. If you're going to do this, and the number one reason people cut up Spanish mackerel for bait is because I've always done it. That's the number one reason people cut up Spanish mackerel for bait is because they always did it. Well, it's been illegal for decades. Doesn't mean anybody ever brought it up. So how many, I mean, we can probably think of a dozen people, instead of doing 70 miles an hour in the interstate, they're doing 75-80 because they always do it.
Right. Doesn't mean they can't still write you a ticket if they want to.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly the same. You know, it doesn't matter if you're going to do it. Now, Robert, these are the most prevalent fish in the harbor right now, or one of the most prevalent.
Yeah.
Where would somebody look for them?
Anywhere where you can get slightly out of the wind right now. But realistically, they are scattered from some days they've been at the 41 Bridge. And even up in the Mayaca close to El Jobin, all the way down through to, they have been offshore, but, you know, because of the wind, we haven't been getting many reports from out there. But
are they following bait? Do we have any bait for them to follow?
Not really. I mean, there's bait fish out there, but they're scattered all over the harbor. I mean, guys are going out looking for tarpon and drifting through the 20-foot holes, coming across, getting a half a dozen mackerel all of a sudden. Another guy is up there by El Jobin fishing under the bridge for mangrove snapper and stuff, makes a couple casts with some of his artificials and catches one or two Spanish macks. You know, they're just in a lot of different obscure spots, and they're not in great numbers.
And they could be almost anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, just about any place you're willing to throw or cast.
3 feet of water on the outside of the bar to 20 feet of water in the middle of the harbor.
They're probably not up your canals.
No.
But
very seldom go into
just about any place
canals
else.
Would be a possible exception because of the width and depth. They're deeper than most of the other areas, so you may find some up in there, but that would be the exception rather than the rule.
I think it'd be a pretty big oddball. If I caught a Spanish mackerel in any canal, I'd be going to play the lottery that night personally.
I think you'd already used your luck up.
Yeah.
Good People point. Always say, oh, well, you know, you did that. You know, now I go play the lottery. I'm like, well, I think you already used the luck. You should have done the lottery instead of that.
Right.
Out in the harbor, the big story is obviously tarpon. Mm-hmm. The tarpon have moved in. Is this cold weather going to have any effect on them?
I'd highly doubt it. I thought the full moon might mess it up a little bit, you know, as far as being in the harbor. And if anything, it brought more fish into the harbor. There's fish basically in all of the 20-foot holes all the way down through the pass and out along the beaches. Haven't heard much reports on the beaches because it's been a little windy, but Knapp's Point down in Sanibel, all along the intercoastal, getting a couple reports in the intercoastal up towards Venice and around the jetties there. Mm-hmm. You know, there's been a lot of fish moved in with this last moon.
All right, Josh, what's your favorite lure for tarpon?
Well, I think we're looking at a DOA baitbuster. I mean, isn't that everybody's favorite lure for tarpon?
Going to kind of say yes. What if you've never thrown a baitbuster? What would be an equivalent? Okay, on the retrieve, I had a guy come in today, and I said, what's your favorite lure to use? What would you be most comfortable throwing? And he said a Hopkins spoon. Now, Hopkins spoon is not like a Johnson Sprite or a Gator or even, you know, some of the pet spoons and stuff. It's more like a lead spoon, where it's a little thicker, it's all punched full of dimples, but it's a smaller profile, but very heavy. You can get amazing distance out of them. Now, could you use the same retrieve on that Hopkins spoon doing a DOA bait buster? Let's go round and round. Yes, no, RJ?
Well, wait a minute. You have to tell us how fast you got to reel that Hopkins spoon. How are you going to retrieve the Hopkins spoon first?
All right. Well, that's a good point. But, Robert, you think you could do one that would be the other, or would you have to modify it?
I think you're going to have to modify it. I don't think there's a way to compare a soft plastic lure to a piece of heavy steel in the water.
But just because DOA bait busters made out of plastic, it's still got a pretty good 1 ounce chunk of lead in it, and a lot of guys just slow roll them. They just crank them in like they kind of like a spoon, I would almost think, just reeling it in.
Right, but even you said that it's not like a normal spoon. It's thicker and heavier.
Right, so it's going to fall faster. You got to reel it faster.
So you made us think we were going to have to reel it faster, and if you reel that bait buster too fast, it just kind of skims across the top and doesn't do anything.
Yeah, because that not plastic for a tarpon, anyway. Makes it a little bit more buoyant in the water with the faster retrieve, or even in faster current. So there's a lot of times where in fast current, that bait buster doesn't work very well, like at the bridges at night.
You got to slow way down with it.
You got to slow.
Or even stop it.
Stop, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of times where I almost fish it virtually still.
RJ, you a Hopkins guy?
No, I'd be more towards something softer, something that's going to make vibration in the water. I'm looking at how tarpon hunt, and when you get down deep where there's not a lot of light, you're going to fish for them differently than if they're on the top. And they've got a giant lateral line down the side, so they hear all kinds of vibrations. They also pick up sounds with their face plates. So I'm more towards things that make noise when I'm fishing for tarpon.
Well, the DOA baitbuster,
or I'm looking for something that is going to attract them smell-wise.
The DOA baitbuster has two small curl tails on it. And people don't think of that because it's rounded, kind of mullet-shaped. And then on the tail, one part goes up with a twist and the bottom goes down with a twist. Technically, a twin curl tail body lure.
Now, here's the thing about that particular bait. I got a bone to pick with Mark Nichols about it because I designed that lure back in 1980 when I was 3 years old. Now, I thought I was drawing a blue whale, but I actually drew a DOA bait buster, curly tails and everything. So,
okay, I want picture proof of this before I go to Mark.
My mom has it, and I'll get it. But
send me a picture of that, so, and I'll talk to Mark about it. But you're going to have to go a ways. You know. But then again, it was only, what, 10, 12 years ago?
1980? Okay. 10 years ago? Yeah. Yeah, about right, 10 years ago, Frank.
So. Robert, a lot of people are getting kind of tired of throwing the DOA bait buster. It is and every year, okay, you're going to go for tarpon. What do you want? DOA bait buster. You got an alternative just for people who are a little, you know, and I guess bored with throwing a bait buster?
the Storm Wild Eyes Swim Shad is a really good alternative.
5-6 inch?
Yeah, definitely the 5 or the 6 inch, either one of those.
Boring.
Okay.
You know, that's one of the main alternatives to it.
But it's boring because you fish it the exact same way.
Give me a non-boring alternative.
How about a great big rattle trap?
I was just thinking, I'm going to vote for that also. Something that makes noise.
A rattle trap. Now, remember years ago, I'm going to vote for a single hook on the back.
Yes.
Pinch the barbs in the front treble, single hook on the back.
Yeah. Taking a treble hook out of a tarpon is no fun.
Maybe get one of those assist hooks that has the piece of hollow core braid attached to it and put that on the back instead of just pinning a regular single hook back there.
That's Robert's trick right there. Robert's been doing that for years before they came out with the single hook replacement for the trebles.
It was just a modification of yours, though.
Yeah, but that was your modification. It really was a great idea. You did it behind Rapala 10s, 12s, bombers. Mm-hmm. You've done it behind a lot of different stuff.
Right.
So what's your feeling on a rattle trap with that?
I think it would probably work. I've never tried it, but I think that would really work.
Now, when you put a single hook on the back of something like a rattle trap, do you put the point so it faces up or so it's pointing down?
Always up. Okay. Fish, when they bite, they're coming down on
it. So you want it up on the top of the mouth. Yeah.
All right. Now, bass fishing right now is just going crazy.
Oh, yeah.
The shiners, the frogs. I mean, we're rebuilding a whole section around our bass stuff with dozens of colors of ribbon worms because people are going back to some of the basics with bass fishing. And the basics of it was a ribbon tail worm. And now frogs, I mean, 4 or 5 times this week, somebody says, where do you got the frogs? I'm thinking about making a frog section because we got the Terminator in one spot, the Strike King in another, Sabeel in another, Scum Frogs in another. I mean, we have all these different brands of frogs, but they're scattered all from hell to breakfast. So should we maybe consolidate them all into one? I don't know.
Yes, but, you should.
You know, we're looking at resetting because with the virus days, everything's a little iffy nowadays. But we're finding a real strong insurgence of inline spinners. Like, guys are looking for the old MEPs with the little fish on them. Now, Rapala, we carry a Rapala imitation of that. And it works great, but it's a lot less money than, you know, the brand name one is. But there's so many things you can do out there. We're cutting down to the wire. Any last thought here, Robert? You got about 15 seconds.
No, I mean, I think you're right with the bass fishing. I mean, a lot of that older style worm is starting to become popular again, and I wouldn't hesitate to use it because I still prefer to use that ribbon-tailed worm. I mean, that's one of my more favorite. It's my confidence lure, without a doubt.
All right, Josh, what are you thinking? Any last thoughts on today?
Well, to go along with your bass fishing, right now I do love a ribbon-tailed worm, but there's no way I'd be using it out there. I'd be using a yellow or a white spinnerbait and trying to hook up with some of those tilapia that are wrapping up their spawning chores. They are hungry, and they are looking for minnows to eat, and they love those spinnerbaits.
So a beetle spin, very tiny.
Nope, bigger. Bigger.
At
least crappie size, and the bass size one does just fine if those fish are big enough to take it.
Okay, and the striking does make a mids bigger than a beetle spin, but smaller than a regular spinnerbait. RJ, any last thought?
It's time to go.
Okay. Well, RJ wants me to get out of here. That's what happens when you live in that golden chrome tower of power with the pearlesque finish.
Let's go fishing. It's an essential activity in Florida.
I like it.
Thanks for listening, guys. Bye. Oh, Josh is the fish coach. If you need somebody to help you with fishing, go to fishcoach.net.
Fishcoach.net.